Hi, I'm Stephen Humphreys from Clover Risk Funding, and this is our podcast In Clover. This is our second episode, and as you already know from listening to the first episode, we do things differently at Clover Risk Funding. We provide a premium one-stop funding service to the insolvency profession, leaning on our experience in the insolvency industry to deliver bespoke solutions that meet the unique needs of liquidators and liquidators' lawyers. It's experience with an edge. Today, I have a very special guest for our second episode. If you're in insolvency, you know who John Winter is. If you're not in insolvency, you're about to find out a little bit about him. Our guest today is John Winter, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the Australian Restructuring, Insolvency and Turnaround Association. Thank you for joining us, John.
Congratulations on getting the name right. It's always an achievement.
Thank you, John. I should declare for everyone who's listening, we just had a conversation about that, because even though I've been in the insolvency industry for more than two decades, I can never remember the name.
For the laugh of your listeners, it is fair to say that every association has a competition to see who can have the longest name, and we do rate very highly on those stakes.
Oh, I think you do. And I think, you know, it's probably just struck me that there will be people listening, potentially from my cricket club, who won't know what ARITA, or the association I might call it, does. Can you give us the bullet points on what ARITA does?
So ARITA is the professional body that represents all of the industry, specifically the practitioners, the accountants, the lawyers, the advisors who work in the broad scope of restructuring, insolvency and turnaround. About 85% of registered liquidators and bankruptcy trustees choose to be ARITA members. You don't need to be an ARITA member, but in so doing, they subscribe to a very high level of professional ethics and review of their conduct. But primarily, as all professional bodies, we're an education and advocacy organisation. About two-thirds of the work we do is focused on education, so that lifts the professional standards of everybody in the industry. And by industry, I mean the wider scope of those that are involved. And also from the advocacy front, we're the prime drivers of law reform in this space. Government view us as the go-to organisation if they want to consult on what's happening in the wider industry, but also around the best way to approach law reform. So we have a very wide remit, and we're a small organisation, but we pack a pretty big punch.
Now, interestingly, we've known each other for a long time, and I don't think I've ever asked you this question, and it was something I was thinking about when I knew you were coming on. How did you end up in insolvency? I know you're not an insolvency guy. How did you end up in insolvency and clearly end up with the passion that you've got for it?
It's a question I often ask myself, how did I end up here? And I am about to clock up 10 years in the role at ARITA, so I have been here quite a while. I have what's best described as a portfolio career, which is a euphemism for I've done a few things. I started out life as an economist, and I ended up getting a lot of media coverage, as a lot of economists do, and that morphed into a marketing and communications function. And I spent a lot of time working in that. I then went back to a recruitment company that I used to work for when I was in that economic space. And when I knew my time at was coming to an end, somebody approached me from the organisation and said, "I've got a great idea, John. Why don't you go and run an accounting body?" And I ended up running the Australian operations of the world's largest accounting body, ACCA. And from there, ended up here, which is not too different. But I came in completely green to insolvency. And it's fair to say that for everybody who comes green into insolvency, it's a very, very steep learning curve. What made it possible for me was, and to quote Einstein, if I've seen further, it's because I stood on the shoulders of giants. I'm very fortunate to have an incredibly smart group of legal and technical directors in ARITA who support me and enhance my knowledge. And so it is hard for people who come from outside this profession to get a grasp of it. But when there's really good people in an industry, as there is in this profession, then you are able to pick this up really well.
And I think that's a really interesting point. You know, regularly in the insolvency industry, we're dealing with first-time participants.
Yep.
Whether they're creditors, whether they're litigants on the other side. It's a difficult industry to get a handle on. You're living and breathing it every day. You mentioned in the first answer that You're heavily involved in advocacy to government. What are the biggest challenges facing the insolvency industry at the moment, if we think near term for the next year and we think kind of medium term into the next 5 years?
And look, I guess that touches on why my background was relevant. A whole lot of what I do is convert the language of the insolvency profession into stuff that everybody can understand. And so that's particularly talking to politicians, talking to the community, talking to media about what goes on within this profession. And so staying a bit of an outsider, by the way, is helpful. That's why I'm never going to become an insolvency practitioner. My skill is in bridging the two communities. What's going to happen? This is why this becomes more important. We're clearly coming into a cycle where we're going to start to see more insolvencies. Despite a lot of the coverage out there, the level of insolvency is still only just at pre-COVID levels, which were themselves record lows. But we are certainly seeing the signs that we're going to see an increased level of financial distress. And so sitting around that are two different factors of concern. One is the human impact on the community, and we need to be talking to government and the community about what that means. And the second impact is what we're going to start seeing in terms of the workload that's going to increase within the insolvency profession and the types of work that they're going to be undertaking. So we're seeing that scale up. That means we need to start talking to government about law reform to make sure that our regime is fit for purpose. Because, as I said, for a long time, we've seen insolvencies declining. We had 28 years of uninterrupted growth before we started to get the impact of COVID. And that's seen a long-term decline in the skill set within the profession because the profession has had to shrink. So we have to start scaling up, supporting the profession to do that. And addressing the fact that we're going to see that different type of work coming in a post-COVID world.
And, I mean, obviously this is a funding broadcast. We haven't talked about litigation funding yet, and we will. I think it's important for our listeners to understand, particularly those not from the insolvency industry, that we talk about insolvency and people just think it's the liquidators. But insolvency, its constituent parts of any insolvency job is the liquidator, the liquidator's lawyers inevitably, probably a valuer, probably a bookkeeper. There'd be probably one in 10 jobs where they're contacting a reader for some sort of guidance. And there's the funder. It really is that kind of team-orientated job in insolvency. So I guess the question that I have for you as the leader of the peak body is, what do you see as the role for funding in insolvency, particularly given that funding is a moderately new thing in insolvency in this country?
It's probably important for everybody to remember that litigation funding in Australia primarily had its roots in insolvency. That's where the first of the big players really came from. And of course, it comes about because in almost every insolvency situation, you're going to reach a point where there's a lack of money to be able to do what you need to do. And it's one of the most important things to note that liquidators write off over $100 million a year of unrecoverable fees. And that's because when they arrive, for the majority of jobs, there's barely enough to actually pay for them to do what's required by law. And a lot is required by law around every time they take an appointment. So litigation funding becomes the lubricant to make the system stay true and to be able to deliver on the promise of finding returns for creditors. Our reality is that there's recoverables out there that are often beyond reach without the support of astute litigation funders. And so that is one of the most pivotal pieces to keep our system going. And the challenge is that there's so much out there that requires it. How do you as a litigation funder approach the volume of work that's there and the complexity that's attached? And so it does become, as you know well, a very symbiotic relationship between funder and liquidator and trying to find that common purpose and the financial outcome that's necessary.
It's a good point that you make, that there is so much out there. And it's something that certainly at Clover we've been working really hard on in the background to try to make our processes more streamlined, to look at approaches that use technology in a better way to try to get from, I think I've got something, to yes, much more quickly. Certainly, it is still really an embryonic industry when you think about it. If you think about, we've had a Corporations Act in some one form or another since 1924. It was probably called the Bankruptcy Act back then. But this has only really been happening since the late 80s or early 90s at best. If you were designing the way a litigation fund worked, or the way the litigation funding was provided to the industry, what do you say are the ways or the main things that funders can do to help the insolvency industry more?
Look, I think what every liquidator is looking for, or even those who are giving advice before you get to the stage of a liquidation, what they're wanting to understand is the tool available for me to access? What are the hurdles I need to cross? And how quickly can I get there to be able to do it? Because when a liquidator takes any appointment from a safe harbour at the pre-appointment point through to the potential of a voluntary administration or a liquidation, at each of those points, they are being overloaded with information. They're being put under enormous time pressure because they have to get things done quickly. And so quite simply, Stephen, I think what people are looking for is a quick and obvious answer so that they can have it factored into their decision making ahead of the point where the decision needs to be made. So knowing what the appetite of the funder is, knowing the hurdles that you've got to cross, and knowing reliably that the funding will be there when you have to call on it.
I think the other thing that I take from that, and it's something that you and I have debated for years, let's be honest, is when to go to a funder. You know, I think I can speak from my experience having been a funder for the better part of the last 7 years and having used funders before that. Historically, I think liquidators, and this is no criticism of liquidators because I've been in these shoes, the limitation periods loom large. And often you get to 3 years into a job and then suddenly it's, oh, I've got these claims that are running out of time. I've got to go and talk to a funder, or I don't have funds to do it. Similarly, with the other limitation period, which is generally 6 years, you get to 5 years, 9 months, and then you're suddenly going, I've got to do something. Certainly from what I took from what you just said, you'd agree with me that the earlier the intervention, or the earlier the start of a conversation with a funder, the better for a liquidator. That has to be the case, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's why I was saying it should be an upfront consideration. It's when you've got the appointment, when you're early stages of it, what's my roadmap in terms of how I'm going to roll this job out? If you're waiting until the 11th hour before you hit statutory times, it's always going to cause problems. But it is still a reality that jobs that are on the tail like that, liquidators carry a huge number of those within their portfolios. It is the nature of the beast, and particularly when you've got those recoverables possibly sitting out there, it is what happens. But, you know, if in the perfect world, if you've got the information you need at the early stages, if you've had those discussions at the early parts of the appointment and you know what the appetite is, well, you know that you can manage your recoveries in the tail much more effectively. But yeah, it's the same advice that we give to directors. Go and get advice early. Talk to a professional early so you've got it in your plan and you've got something ready when you need it.
And I think that leads directly into my next question, which is, you know, we see litigation funding, and certainly I think this is from all participants in the industry. I need funding when it's a liquidation. For the non-insolvency listeners, liquidation is the end of the road.
Yep.
We have a number of other paths to liquidation in the Australian insolvency law, most particularly voluntary administration. But we don't, and certainly in my career, I haven't seen much or at all really a funding focus from any of the participants in the market on providing funding support when a company's in voluntary administration or providing support when the company's entered into a deed of company arrangement. Again, you or a reader have any views on the shifting that paradigm into, well, the earlier the better, but why not in a voluntary administration?
And look, that was where my comment around voluntary administrations was touching on. I think there's incredible potential for that. I think there are astute funders in the market, not on the litigation funding side, but funders who do specialise in getting involved in VAs. But increasingly, I know that there is appetite amongst litigation funders to consider what can be done. So again, when you're running a VA, where you know that there's different ways that you can pursue actions, where you've got money to back you up, all of that increases the likelihood that you will save an organisation. And a voluntary administration, in its very architecture, is designed to save businesses. That's what it's all about. So when you know you've got access to funding, be it capital or be it lit funding or any other type of equity that you can bring in to make this work, you've actually then got options. And we need to get, as practitioners, as an industry, we need to get more astute at being able to use those options to deliver better outcomes. And we haven't had a lot of big VAs over the last decade. You can name them on a couple of hands. But we're going to see more of them as we come into the next 2 to 3 year period. And, you know, there's not for a second am I suggesting that we're going to see some sort of insolvency tsunami or Armageddon, but there's definitely pressure coming into the economy in the medium term, and it will start affecting big businesses where VAs work really well. And having that optionality is what's going to help get better outcomes.
I wasn't going to ask about notions of insolvency Armageddons or tidal waves or the like coming, because I think you and I fundamentally agree. I think, you know, that we read a lot, and it frustrates me because I try to read as much as I can in the press about what's happening, and I probably should stop that because I see the press, it seems to me, really pumping up. It's coming, there's a wave coming, and then you read the article about a company that has gone into liquidation. And I know from experience of being the day one person on these things, it is probably the third worst day in the employees' and the directors' lives.
Yep.
It's shocking. Any company going to liquidation or going through an insolvency event is shocking, but you read these articles and you think that another Virgin's gone into voluntary administration, and quite frankly, it's a company with 5 employees and $100,000 in debt owing. So I certainly agree with you. I don't think we're going to see an insolvency Armageddon. Is it your view that we're probably going to get back to the levels that are probably more normative, so the 2012, 2013 type levels? You mentioned that pre-COVID we were in historical lows. What does being in a historical low mean for the market?
There's a lot there to unpack, but at the starting point, I need to go back and say, March 2020, when the government announced the whole range of stimulus around COVID, which included JobKeeper, there were a whole range of insolvency protections, etc. All of those, including protections around commercial leases, defaults on loans, etc., all of those were meant to come to an end at the same time, 6 months after that announcement. I was one of the people that said we're looking at an insolvency Armageddon, because if you're going to pull all of those things out at once, you're going to create a shock in the market, which was going to have a devastating and very immediate impact. And somewhat unsurprisingly, those various measures were actually tailed out, not all withdrawn at once. You know, JobKeeper got extended, the arrangements around commercial leases were smoothed. So that cliff suddenly disappeared. And also coming out of that, by the fact that those protections were extended and a lot of money was pumped into the economy through direct stimulus, what you saw was companies not going into insolvency. So insolvencies halved overnight and they stayed that way until about March last year. And that was also supported by the fact that the ATO did not re-enter the market to enforce on ATO collectible debt. The ATO started doing that last year, and they started issuing a record number of director penalty notices and caution notes. And so that started to get people back to considering their financial viability. But it's really important to note, that that stimulus actually created a vast number of zombie companies. A lot of those zombie companies have just ghosted out of the market. They didn't go through a proper formal insolvency process, but they did have a lot of money that kept them going for a bit longer, and it shouldn't necessarily have done that. Insolvency plays an incredibly important part in the economy. Despite the human cost, which can never be understated, insolvency at the right level is very good for an economy because what it does is drive efficiency. It takes inefficiently used capital, capital that's invested in bad businesses not doing good things, and it reallocates or frees those up to better performing organisations. And I always caveat by saying you can't underestimate the human cost of where that impact happens. But from a purely economic perspective, it is necessary and it is vital. And one surprising thing, the OECD made a statement in one of its research papers a few years ago. Effective exits of businesses create a greater productivity boost than the startup of a new business. And so you've got to look at it from that perspective. So managing all of this going forward, we have the factor of there are some businesses that do need to go broke that were propped up during this period. We will see that causing a bit of a gentle increase. There's been a lot of pressures in the economy through COVID, through the Ukrainian war, etc., where we've seen supply chain restrictions, massive increases in supply chain costs, obviously the ramping up of inflation. And now, obviously, we're seeing interest rates going back up to more normal levels where they're at historic lows. All of those factors come together to put some strain in the economy. But we've seen this coming. Interest rates haven't been all increased at one go. It's been 25 basis points once a month. It's been ratcheted up slowly. So all of that means that organisations can and are adjusting progressively. That means no tsunami. That means no cliff. Take all of those things away. Look at the people who are actually still forecasting it. And I'll tell you that they've all got a reason for wanting you to be panicked. And when the insolvency industry body says, folks, don't panic, be alert, not alarmed, I'd probably take our counsel on that rather than others, because we are saying you can get through this next period if you take good advice, if you're watching your P&L, if you're understanding where your cash flow is. You'll get through this in all likely instances. You don't need to panic. But as we've seen in the construction sector, Stephen, as somebody who might retain a building company to build, a mum and dad to build their next home, you've got to be astute in who you're picking as your partner. You've got to watch what they're doing and not keep giving them cash without thinking about what you're doing. Same goes for subbies on the other side. If your bills aren't being paid, you need to look seriously at whether or not you should be continuing to give service there, because the likelihood of you losing what you're owed is getting pretty significant.
Yeah, I think we are moving to this phase of more personal responsibility. It's not going to stay the same. It can't. It couldn't stay the same. And I, you know, you think about the pre-COVID levels, and I was sitting in a very different role during COVID, and I was one of the ones, along with you, who was saying, firstly, if we don't do something, Armageddon. And then when we did do something, if you pull it all off, it's going to be Armageddon again.
Yeah.
So we're moving into a phase of probably going back to where the normal level is. Industry by industry, there might be some different pockets, and I think construction, having done a renovation during COVID, is certainly an area where I think we should be probably a little bit more alert than alarmed. You also mentioned law reform, and I can't have you speaking to me without talking about law reform. We've been talking about it for as long as we've known each other.
Yep.
You know, if there was one thing, if we could both blink and one thing would change in the way in insolvency law, in the way insolvencies occur, what would that be for you? One thing, you get to change one thing right now. What would it be?
The Corporations Act.
So the whole thing.
Yeah.
So we've
ended up in a situation where, as I describe it, our law has been pancaked over decades. So we've had lots of well-intentioned improvements, but nobody's ever stopped since the Harmer Inquiry of the 80s and gone, what are we doing here and are we fit for purpose? And so bits have been added on, and it becomes, you talk about renovations, it's like that house that's getting add-on after add-on after add-on without a vision for what the thing looks like at the end. And it ends up a mess, invariably, unless you start cutting back into the original structure. So we have some truly great law in Australia. The voluntary administration regime is one of the best things in the world. It's why Australian practitioners are very proud of it. We can tinker with that and improve it, but it is better than Chapter 11. And most people don't really take that appreciation. But then you look at the jumble of other stuff that's around it, and we get to a really profound conclusion on this. Our law is not fit for purpose because the people who use it don't understand it. And there's a whole bunch of liquidators and insolvency lawyers who've gone, I understand it, what's he talking about? No, the people who use it are directors and creditors, and they don't understand it. And the fact that an organisation like ARETA has to pump out so much advice, so much training, actually is a symptom of how bad the law has become. It's become too complex. You can't stay on top of it. So what hope do the primary users of insolvency law have? And that's where we find ourselves. So we've been calling for a root and branch review of insolvency law for half a decade. We think we're getting close to being able to get that delivered. But it's a long process. It's a 3-5 year process. But the start of that, I think, is coming. And what we need to do is make sure that at the end of it, we have a law that people can look at, that directors who are struggling with their business, and by directors, I also mean the tradie who's got a little PTY LTD business, could be a plumber with 3 or 4 employees, that she knows that she's in a bit of distress and these are her options. Mm. If we can achieve that, all of a sudden the economy improves. People get to keep their jobs. And so that's the one thing I want. It just happens to be pretty large.
Well, I think that one thing is the one thing that anyone who's been in insolvency for some time wants. I mean, you've heard me on the bully pulpit, Insolvency Act. Insolvency Act, Insolvency Regulator. You know, we all want that. I guess I have a fear. I obviously have a very specific focus in my insolvency world now, which is litigation funding. 3 years ago, we had litigation funding reform. It lasted 2 years, and then it was completely wiped off the map by an incoming government. To get real reform, it obviously needs to be bipartisan. Do you think that is something that we will have this time?
Well, it's something we've worked really hard towards, and I have to acknowledge both sides of the houses in the recent Parliamentary Joint Committee inquiry into corporate insolvency came together. There was no dissenting report. There was no politics that were involved in this. It was actually, from an advocacy viewpoint, a joy to behold how it operated. Do we completely agree with everything that they put in the report? No, but we do with about 95%. Mm. I think a lot of people, a lot of practitioners that I keep hearing from when we talk about this root and branch reform say, please don't do it. Don't do it. It's too risky. Being afraid of trying to get the law right is not a good enough reason not to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, unless you are out there trying to lead and get a better outcome, you're guaranteed to get a worse outcome. And so, you know, fear of the unknown, fear of uncertainty is not a reason not to do this. Will we get what our profession would consider the perfect outcome through the law reform process? No, we won't, because there's other stakeholders and other people should have a say in this too. You know, we need to listen to the financial counsellors. We need to listen to the legal rights centres. We need to listen to communities. You know, you think about some of the really big insolvencies. The town of Whyalla would not exist if Arium wasn't saved. There's a community concern there that needs to be considered in what insolvency law does and who the stakeholders are in it. And so we need to think big about this, and we need to understand that you can't have being perfection the enemy of the good, and we need to at least get to the good.
If you're still listening to us, thank you. We did go down a little bit of a path there that I let us down. That was very insolvency wonkish. I've loved every second of it. I've only got two more questions, so bear with us, listeners. You and I both know that insolvency is a tough game. It's a tough game. And I mentioned before, you're a viewer of often the second or third hardest thing someone will ever go through. You're an avid sailor, just like I'm an avid cricketer. Tell me, going out in the boat, you know, you go out in the boat once a week, twice a week. How important is that to you, getting out on the water, to being effective in your day-to-day role in what is a really tough industry to work in?
Really important to note, it's not my yacht.
If we can start off everyone with that. To think that. I wanted everyone. That's why I went that way.
I am but a mere humble crew member. And you know what? Being a mere humble crew member is actually what I love most about it. You know, this is a high-pressure job. It is a high-pressure industry. It is what our members do at Arita is incredibly tough work. They are some of the most astonishingly impressive professionals I've ever come across. It's why I'm still here 10 years on. But you need a break away from this. You need to get some mental clarity in order to be at your best. And just like you can't take your mind off a fast bowler coming down the pitch at you, when you're out yacht racing, your phone's underneath. You can't touch your phone because it goes over the side. So it actually provides a really nice break away from things where you have to think about different things. And that brings you back fresh to do your job better the next day. Mm. And, you know, I've only recently got back into yacht racing after many, many years out of it. And it is something that, you know, I'm now becoming a bit of an advocate of, not of the yacht racing piece itself, but of saying to the professionals that I work with in this industry, find yourself an opportunity to be able to put the tools down and clear the head, because it's really good for you and it increases your productivity quite dramatically. You know, and if that means that you leave the office a little bit early one day a week to go and do it, go and do it, because you do a better job the next day.
Yeah, and that probably leads me to my most important thing. If I could blink and I'd change one thing, you know how strong an advocate I am around mental health and mental health of professionals. If I could blink and something changed tomorrow, it would just be that we were better to each other as practitioners, and we all got that extra time to just go and do something outside of work. You know, it is so important. All right, a couple of rapid fires, getting to know John Winter before we go. These are things I probably do know the answers to, but our listeners won't.
Do they really want to know?
Yes, they do, because this is something that I'm going to bring in for every podcast from here on in. So we're trying it with you. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Rugby league or AFL?
AFL. Avid Swans fan.
Seafood or steak?
Surf and turf.
So why not both? Why did I not know you giving me a straight answer? Finally, Apple or Samsung?
Oh, Apple.
Had to be. Look, guys, listeners, we've been privileged to have John Winter with us, the Chief Executive Officer of Arita. I only got the name right once. I'm not going to get it right.
Good enough, mate.
We've taken much more of your time up than we intended to. Thank you for coming on to the second episode of In Clover, and thank you for everything you do for our industry.
It's an absolute pleasure, and really glad to be here.
John Winter, everyone.